Just a quick note before we get started here. I used different software to edit this special edition of Built to Go, and, well, it's not perfect, so I apologize if things sound a little strange. But the content, I promise you, is worth listening to. Thanks for your patience. Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time we have a very special episode. It's a special interview episode. We don't do these very often, but this time we're talking with exactly the right person to answer questions about RVs and camper vans and the differences and all the technical things, because he is an RV tech. And I'm going to let him introduce himself right now. Go ahead.
Hello, Built to Go community. My name is Sherm. I'm 26 years old. I am an RV tech at a local tech dealer down here in the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Just a little bit of background about myself. I am currently not doing van life, sadly. I have a 1977 Volkswagen bus that I am currently restoring, so me, my wife, and our two cats can travel around the entire U.S. That is our dream. I am posting videos on social media at The Green Machine on pretty much any platform you can imagine. So if you guys want to check me out, that's cool. But that's not what we're here to really talk about. We're here to talk about RVs versus camper vans.
Yes.
So I have been working as an RV technician for about 2 years now. I've worked for a couple of different dealers. I'm working for a nice little local dealer. Let's talk about the differences between RVs and self-converted camper vans.
This is a very important distinction. An RV is made by a company and it is certified by the RVIA, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's a key difference. Whereas your camper van, well, it's technically not legal in many places. We're not going to get into that so much. I mean, there is an argument to be made that no self-built camper van is legal unless it's been approved by the RVIA. That is a distinction, is that an RV has been certified by an agency that it is safe-ish.
Pretty much, yeah. So the RVIA is basically just making sure that everything is put together in the right way and that there's a certain standard for mass-produced vehicles.
Yeah.
And for the self-converted vans, it's a one-of-one. Like, you are comfortable with what you're capable of doing, so the only one suffering if anything goes wrong is you. And hey, honestly, a lot of people do better jobs.
If I get, say, a Winnebago Travato versus buying that same van base, if you bought out your own ProMaster van versus the $150,000 Travato, the Travato would be certified and you would be building out the ProMaster yourself, but you would build it out differently. So talk about those two vehicles coming into your shop, the Travato and the self-built out ProMaster.
All right. So the biggest difference that I've seen is just build quality. So, and that's not knocking the van self DIYers at all. If anything, it's kind of giving them some props. So often these mass produced Sprinter van build outs, obviously you start off with the same frame. So you're on equal footing already. But what these production companies have advantage over the self DIYers is that they have done iteration on iteration on iteration in the exact same van, probably thousands of times. Like, they have built them out, tested them. I don't like this. We'll rip it out, do it again. They have the disposable income to do that. For us, DIY self, like van life people, it is, we have one van, we build it out once, maybe twice sometimes, and you'll improve small things. And then it's, you know, this is how it's going to be. And I'm cool with this. It's my van and I've built it out how I want it to be.
Right. With a Travato, for example, yeah, year to year things matter. We've all heard about the COVID era RVs and such. But with self-builds, you're getting a much higher build quality in many cases, or you're getting just garbage. You know, like, people have their electrical wires just taped together. They've got 18 AWG wired up to 10 AWG with no fuses. You know, it's all over the place.
It can be a big difference. For build quality, I'm more talking about, I guess, the like the physical appearance. If we're going into component wise, yes, that is not something that everybody has experience in. And while I do believe, like, everybody can do anything for the most part, if you put enough time and effort into something, like, I think everybody can do just about anything.
Yeah, me too. I agree.
Yeah, it's hard. And I'm not saying that it would take you like a couple days. Like, building out my van, I'm still, you know, I have the entire back floor cut out right now. I have Flintstoned the sucker to the umpth degree. I didn't know how to do any of this when I popped out the womb. So like,
right.
It takes time. I've had this van since I was 13.
Wow.
And I'm still fixing it. I have enjoyed it. I haven't just like been working on it this whole time. I have done proper van life in it before. And I want to build that bed. I want to build AC and everything. And
I'm in the same situation. I'm just waiting on the temperature. All right. If you've got a lot of money and you don't have a lot of experience, it is very easy to just go out and buy an RV and then you have everything you need. You're ready to go. However, you are now dependent on people. You have this incredibly complicated thing that if anything goes wrong, you are at a serious deficit for fixing it because the DIY people, they did it themselves. They know where stuff is. Like, I know a lot of RVers who have no idea where their water pump is. They hear a little noise that comes out from under the fridge somewhere, but that's it.
Right. So whenever you buy a pre-built out Sprinter van, you don't know where stuff is. So if you do buy a pre-converted Sprinter van, definitely just dig around. Before you put anything in it, just dig around, try and find where everything's at. You should get like a thick old packet of all of your basically instruction manuals for all of your different components. Keep those. Don't burn them, or just take a picture of like the exterior of them, get like a phone number off of them because that'll come in handy. It will. But that is kind of a big thing is we've had these iterations over and over again, and a lot of stuff is really cramped in some areas. It feels like these vans are really big and they have so many components, but with more components and more things to break, things tend to break more.
Right.
So the more simple you can keep a van to, obviously the less problems you're going to have in the future.
Right.
Something else I do want to touch on is the build quality. With these, you know, so with the self-converted Sprinter vans, the DIY people don't have access to all the same materials as the production people do.
Right.
We might be able to go to Home Depot, Lowe's and get a 2x4 or a 1x2. And I have framed out my bus interior, my first bus interior. I did that. I had all wood and it did crack over time, but it looked awesome when I had it first done. It lasted me a whole summer. That's what I needed it to do. I built it for a specific purpose and it fulfilled that purpose. And a lot of the DIY people, that's what we want to do. We just, and we get out there, we'll do the van life that we're wanting to do. And then if we want to dig it out and do it again, we have that option. With these converted Sprinter vans, you have a lot of like aluminum extrusion.
Yeah.
And
the good stuff.
The good stuff that does not warp at all, but is also very expensive and hard to get at a good price for an individual. These people are buying aluminum extrusion en masse for a discount. Plus, they don't pay taxes on it because they're a company. And then they're building it into thousands of Sprinter vans. So they have the excess to do what they need to with it.
Plus, they can mold custom fiberglass pieces and you know, all that stuff that we just don't have. In the case of Airstream, they built their own window factory. Basically, they make all that stuff in-house.
Exactly. Which, hey, you know what, if you can only get your stuff at Home Depot and Harbor Freight or Lowe's, then you got a lot of those around, so if something breaks, then you have access to some easier stuff too.
That's
definitely that could be a pro.
Yeah,
I guess.
And so DIY, something goes wrong on the road, you pretty much have to fix it yourself because not a lot of people are willing to work on DIY rigs because, I mean, you can understand why. You certainly can understand why because you don't know what you're getting into. You've been trained in all this stuff, but you're in this weird thing with all the stuff made out of pallets. Talk about the reality of, will an RV dealer ever work on a DIY rig?
So what I have heard through the grapevine, I actually heard that Camping World is working on self-converted rigs.
That's big news. I need to get that out there because I'm always having trouble finding places to tell people like, oh, I need to have my diesel heater installed. No one will do it. And I'm like, well, yeah, because it's dangerous and weird. And I've sent them to automotive body shops. Body shops will often do weird electrical stuff for some reason. Nelly, who's a listener, had a vent installed, a custom vent, and the only place that would do it was the auto body shop. But if you're telling me now that some Camping Worlds will do things like add solar to a DIY rig or a diesel heater, that is big news.
So I don't 100% know if it's like location per location or if it's nationwide, but that is something I have heard through some of my other tech friends who are working at Camping Worlds.
Okay.
So it's, do with it what you will.
So if someone brought in let's say they bring in a regular old Coleman camping trailer, okay?
Okay.
And they say they want you to add solar to it. Is that something you can do?
Yeah, that's okay. Absolutely something we could now, do, yeah.
If they bring in a DIY camper van, what would you say?
So if they wanted solar on the roof, typically that would end up being a few more hours. Since it is a custom build, it takes a little bit more time to like, hey, we got to find where we can drill through the roof on this because, well, you've got your vent mounted here and we will see some of the same units. I call them units. It's just the lingo, if you will.
Yeah.
So rig units. We see a lot of the same rigs. So that time definitely is going to come into the pay.
Yeah.
If you are doing a self-converted, but if you're at a loss for like all options, you just can't figure out how to do it, then it's an option. And having an option is better than not having one at all.
Let's drill down a little bit on this one example, and then we'll move on to something else. But okay, so I want 200 watts of solar on my roof, and I need a solar charge controller, but I already have the battery. Okay, so two 100 watt panels. Now, if I'm doing this DIY, I'm like, I can get those for about $70 each on Amazon. And if I don't care about efficiency, I can get a PWM controller for $10, add in another $20 for wiring and fuses, and I'm solared for under $200 if I do it myself. What does that compare to me coming to you flat with my Sprinter that's nicely converted but doesn't have solar, and I say, hey, I want solar? How much money are we talking?
All right. I'm the guy who turns the wrench. I'm not the guy who checks you out at the counter.
Yep.
So I try not to think about that kind of stuff. But maybe I should. Maybe I should. Because, gosh, I don't want to be charging everybody over what, you know, we need to. But at the same time, I know that locally, this what we're charging down here, at least. And so the labor rate, I know at the local camping world is about $200 an hour per hour, which is a lot.
Sure.
But it tends to be definitely over $100, $150 for most locations. The place I'm working at, I think, is like $160. And that's another thing. It's like, you don't know what you don't know until you get into it.
Yeah.
So I could drill a hole in your roof and then, oh my gosh, why would he wire this cable right here?
Right.
Obviously, he should have ran this through the wall and not exactly where my drill bit just went. So now I have to rewire all of this. And typically, like, if people mess things up, we have like shop bill hours for stuff like that. So like if we break something, which happens, it happens.
Yeah. Of course.
You know, we're people in the world, things happen.
Yeah.
So if everything goes smoothly, possibly 2 hours, the technicians have to break it down. We get the ticket in from the advisor who sits up at the front desk. And this guy wants solar installed on his van, on his self-converted van. I will end up being the one who bids the time to do the job. So it's not somebody at the front desk giving you like a fake promise of like, oh, we can get it done in this amount of time. Now, some people do that, which isn't the place that I work at personally.
Don't they have the book? You know, like, you know, there's the book, right? That says an alternator takes 2 hours, you know.
There is. That's typically more for warranty stuff. So whenever you're dealing with a company like Dometic or Furion, they have their book that they will go by. Mm-hmm. And again, every case is different. So there might be this door that's in the way that I have to remove in order to do that. And that's an extra 0.1 of an hour. And it will boil down to like 6 minute intervals at some points.
Wow.
And so, yes, sometimes just screwing a screw in will be, that's 0.1 of an hour. It only takes me a hole of about 30 seconds, but that's the lowest increment that we can go. So I'll say, hey, you know what? I have to get up on the roof. I have to install this solar panel. So that's going to be like an hour and a half to do. Then I have to put, you know, butyl tape and dicor on top of all the screw holes so that way it doesn't leak inside.
Yes.
That's going to be another 0.5 hours. And then I have to, the solar port on the top, that's going to be another half hour. I have to run the cables through. I have to connect it to the batteries. It divides all into those little segments.
Interesting.
And so, gosh, and it's another one of the things, like, where's the battery located? Am I going to have wall panels to get to it? Or do I just staple it to the wall and make it look bad?
It's an empty van. They came to you first. I'm going to build out this van, but I want to have solar in here. So you get there and there's a battery sitting in the back of the van. So how long do you think that would take?
So let's say getting up on the roof, that's 1 hour. We have, you know, screwing it, or we screw it in, get it up there just to put it on the roof, an hour. And then dicor in the top, which you also have to account for product.
Sure.
So
yeah,
very good for screws. So then like I'd say 0.5 hours for doing a roof seal. And that would include the solar port as well. That would probably be another 0.5 hours.
Yep. The gland.
Yes. The gland. I think we call it a solar port or just like a hook. I don't know. The gland. That's gross.
I'm glad to hear that the professionals don't call it that, because that gives me an excuse not to call it that.
Yeah, solar port, which sounds like you could plug into it, but the wires just run through right. it, drilling a hole in the roof. I got to do that.
Yeah, you do.
I got to deburr all the edges too. And then another thing is I have to supply all of my own tools to do this work.
Yeah.
I do not buy Snap-on, go to garage sales. And if I can find a nasty old wrench, that's the only time I'll hop on that Snap-on truck.
Mm-hmm.
But that's me personally. People can say what they want about Harbor Freight, but that's tends to be my place to go for all of my personal stuff at the very least.
Their quality is variable. You know, you got to buy the right things, but some of it's great.
Exactly. Okay. So 1 hour for solar panel, half an hour to seal it all up, half an hour to put in the gland, 0.3 hours to drill the hole, draping it down, hooking up batteries. I would say if I'm bidding for the whole solar hookup, I'm going to say like an hour and a half, 1.5 hours. And then you have all of the product. So
you may adjust your pricing a little bit maybe, but you will allow people to bring in their own stuff.
I would call people before you even go anywhere just to make sure, like, if I bring my AC in, can you guys install it?
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Then they'll try and schedule you to come in at a later date.
So I can get a panel for $70 off of Amazon. I'm guessing a 100-watt rigid panel from you is going to be retail, maybe even retail plus.
Probably, yes. Yeah. And then we only carry certain brands as well.
Sure. What I've noticed is that RVs use completely different components than we do DIY. Like a friend of mine, Hal, who's been on the show, he had his solar put in his trailer at an RV dealer, and they use just weird stuff to me, like GoPower. Uh-huh. And then when I got my Tiki Bago, it had a GoPower in it. And then my Airstream also has GoPower in it, but this is not stuff I've encountered in the van life world.
There are very specific things for RVs, like furnaces. That's a big thing. A lot of people have been going for the Suburban.
Yes,
is a big one.
Yeah,
we'll also have Atwood. Dometic, and yes, Atwood is a little bit older now. I can't remember who bought them out.
Wow.
I actually worked on a truck camper like a week ago, and he was saying he was having an AC issue, and it was an Atwood AC.
Oh, wow.
I think Dometic bought them out.
Yeah, I think they're buying everybody.
I have not seen one of those in my time. It was a 2009 truck camper, and it was working all fine. It was working fine. It just takes a little bit to kick on, but that's, oh my gosh, diagnosing it took a little bit longer than I thought it would.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, let's add up the time here.
Yeah.
So 1 hour, 2.5, 3.5. I would say like 3.7 hours to do that. And that's my personal bid on the spot right now.
Yeah. And the advisor's got a role in this too. The advisor should be like, no, this is wrong.
Right. And bidding the time is subjective per technician. I mean, sometimes if an advisor thinks something's a little too high priced, they'll go to another technician, say, hey, what would you bid on this? You know,
gotcha.
Would you do this for cheaper? Do you think you could do this for this amount of time? You can always try and work stuff out with your advisor. We have somebody who's dedicated who quotes for parts, and all they know is parts, and they have access to all of the dealer's information, all of the product dealer's information. We will say, hey, it's going to need this part. I don't know how much that part is. You figure that out, and then I know how much time it's going to take. So I know that our base rate is between $150 and $200.
Mm-hmm.
I try and keep that in mind if I can while I'm working on somebody's vehicle, especially, you know, a self-converted thing. But sometimes like, hey, I can only starve so much as a flat rate technician. And then, oh my gosh, we're not going to get into that because I almost did. The flat rate thing, and everybody can have an opinion on that. And as me personally, who's in that position, who also tries to be as ethical as possible, it's a hard knock life.
Oh, yeah. No, you're trying to make money doing an honest job, and the people bringing their stuff in are trying to get stuff done at the lowest price. And then there's someone in the between you who's trying to make as much money as possible.
Right.
And they will take advantage of both sides.
Yes. Ring, ding, ding, ding. You've won the prize, Jeff.
That's how it works in almost any industry. You know, yeah, I won't talk about my wife too much, but she's a doctor, and I can tell you very similar things happen there, and it's not the doctor's fault, but we'll put that aside for now. So what we're talking about here is obviously DIY, you're going to save a lot of money if you have the skills to do these things or you're willing to learn them. However, that costs a thing more than money. It costs time. I can bring all this stuff into you, and at the end of the day, I've got a solar system. Whereas I do it myself, and I have to figure everything out, that could take weeks.
It could take a little bit.
Yeah.
I will say, if you're doing it yourself, though, and you break down on the side of the road, you put it together. You know how it went together. And if something went awry, you know where to find it. And you might be able to fix it.
That was one of the big problems I had with the ambulance, just to point this out, is that my first van was an empty van. I built it all out myself. I knew where everything was. The ambulance was a nightmare because there was no schematic. It had miles of wiring. Even the dealer, I called them up, who built it originally, they didn't know where this stuff was. Literally nobody on the planet knew how this thing was done. And I had to figure it all out myself. So keep that in mind. If you're thinking about building out a van versus buying one, how comfortable are you with relying on other people? Because that's what this boils down to.
Yeah.
So earlier I asked folks on the Facebook group and on Discord some specific questions they would like to ask you. So let's go through some of those. And a big one, and we could spend probably weeks talking about this, is how do vans compare for reliability of cost of repairs? Now, to be clear, you are an RV tech, not an automotive tech, although I understand you do have a lot of automotive experience, which is not necessarily typical for RV techs. I mean, they're different things.
Different spaces entirely.
Yeah.
They do have a very small overlap.
Coming from that perspective, in your opinion only, and I know you have a Volkswagen, but they're no longer sold in the US, so we're going to put them aside.
So sad.
If you could choose any one of the following vans as a brand new vehicle, which would you choose? So you've got the Sprinter, you've got the ProMaster, you've got the two different Chevys that they keep saying they're going to cancel and then are never do. You've got the Econoline Cutaway, and then you've got the Transit. If you're going to buy a brand new van, which of those would you buy?
Okay, so I have had experience at an RV dealer before. I've worked at a Toyota dealership as just like an express tech. I did that for a few months. So I've seen a lot of Toyotas come through. And I've seen...
We can't get the high ace here.
So sad, because that would be my first choice, honestly, because I've found that the Japanese and Asian brands end up being a little bit more reliable than things in the US. Yes. And I believe that's purely because we don't have a lot of industry here in the United States.
Right. That's true. Would you do a Sprinter?
So Sprinter van, for mechanical wise, I would probably stay away from diesels because I do not have specific experience with diesels.
But even you're saying no diesels, which I agree with. I think the time for diesels has passed in this space. If you're getting a giant diesel pusher, that's a whole other world. But for vans, I would say no diesel. And it sounds like you agree with that.
Yes. There is something to be said about torque. So if you do have a heavy loaded vehicle, maybe consider a diesel. But if you're buying something and you just have like a Sprinter van, I wouldn't think it would be necessary. Maybe get a slightly bigger gas engine if you can afford it.
Yeah.
But the diesels, I personally don't believe it's worth all of the extra hassle. I've had a buddy when I was a whitewater raft guide. Mm-hmm. He was living in his Ford Transit, and that sucker never really had any problems. I think he drove that sucker all the way around.
Yeah.
And I know each different van has its own different problems. Mm-hmm. So some vans are more notorious for having cooling issues. Some are more notorious for, you know, transmission issues. But for Transit, Ford Transit, I like the space in them. I love how the high tops look on them. I would buy a Transit.
Okay. And my argument for Transits is that you can get them fixed anywhere, whereas a lot of these others, especially Sprinters, it's a nightmare.
Yes. I am more of a German, European mindset. Well,
of course, with Volkswagens.
Of course, yes.
Yeah.
And then, like the Asian market as well, I love the Toyotas and
me too.
Mitsubishis and whatnot. So,
what do you think about the old big American van, like the Econolines that are only cutaways now, and then the Chevy Express and what's the other one?
I love seeing an old van. Period. I love old things. I love the classic things because the production of things now is not how it used to be. A lot of plastic panels in things. And so I like having the heavy metal. It might be a little heavier, but It's a little bit more durable.
Let's talk about that line then between an RV tech and an automotive tech. So, for example, I bring in my Travato because that's my example to go to, and I've got two problems, right? My roof AC isn't working, which I'm assuming is something you see fairly often.
Yes.
And my front AC isn't working. Would you touch that?
The line that we've drawn between the camper side and the house side, as we call it, the most mechanical thing that we will tend to touch is like an alternator, or we'll do oil changes.
Okay.
We only deal with the house side and anything directly related to the operation of the house side.
Right.
So we had a Class B. Here's an example. We had a Class B that came in not too long ago. So a Sprinter van, and it was having charging issues for the camper battery.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had looked at the alternator, and somebody else at a different dealership, another RV dealership, had swapped out the alternator, and they'd also swapped out the camper battery. And it was a newer unit, so fortunately the customer didn't have to pay for the battery and like the actual products themselves, because it was all still under warranty. But we'll swap out an alternator if we think it has a problem, if the technician is comfortable with it. That's kind of the biggest thing, because hey, we all want money. That's the biggest thing at the end of the day. If a technician feels comfortable at an RV dealership dealing with that level of RV, like camper repair, then we can touch it. We're not going to be doing like engine rebuilds in the shop, because that is definitely automotive. We will swap brakes on trailers, and we will replace axles on trailers. That's about as far as I know that we go. And we'll do oil changes as well. Like I've done in the past week, 2 diesel pusher oil changes plus generator changes.
Lucky you. All those
pushers
and
no. Those
lifting up the bed to crawl into the engine bay or whatever you have to do.
Gosh, I've been fortunate it's all been on the back end.
That's
but
good.
I've had those instances where you have to take off the doghouse and like all up in there. Oh gosh. And then you're trying to keep everything clean while you're like a diesel mechanic, like going in there, touching all of the fabrics.
Yeah, you're in someone's $400,000 rolling mansion right next to white leather seats as you're covered in grease. It's wonderful.
Send it to detail. It'll be fine.
Yeah,
Detail will deal with it. Oh my gosh. I try to make things as easy for the next person as I can, but man, sometimes it's hard.
Okay, so that gives the listeners a general idea. It's like, just because you have a Class B RV doesn't mean that your RV dealer is going to fix every last thing. Some of it is still, it's just a van and an engine, and they have to deal with it.
Correct.
You know, the regular automotive dealers. What are the most common failures you see on the house side?
So it's kind of funny. Everybody's got a different opinion, and a lot of people deal with different things. It is mostly the things that move. So if there is a component that does a job, it will fail. That is what I've gotten from everybody.
Yeah.
But the more complex a system becomes, the more things that can fail. And when you have that opportunity to fail, things happen. One of my technicians who's been working for 30 years in the RV industry, typically ACs in the summer, furnaces in the winter, because you notice them. A lot of people have said stuff about build quality in the campers and the RVs, at least the mass produced ones. And that's kind of one of those downsides and differences that we talked about in the self-converted vans versus the Class Bs.
Yeah. So is the COVID thing real? Like, do you think that rigs made in 2020, 2021 are worse than earlier ones?
Personally, I believe so. During COVID, I actually was doing some traveling around, thankfully, which was kind of cool. From what I noticed, a lot of production all over was poor, definitely. I was a welder in a shipyard down here in Mississippi, and a lot of the ships that I noticed, I was on the LHA-8, so it was an aircraft carrier.
Wow.
And they build them like Legos. They'll make them in giant sections, building blocks.
And then they weld them together.
They weld them together. And then they'll pipe through everything. So I noticed, and a lot of my older welding buddies and, you know, foremans and whatnot would always talk about how bad the quality was and how off kilter everything was.
Yeah.
It made normal life harder. For sure. And so people being out in the world and having to have their distances between everybody, and you can't just go over to your buddy.
Right.
Who says, hey, I need you to come look at this right now. Well, okay, we have to separate, but I need you to come look at this and tell me. And I can't just like point out to you, hey, this gap's too big. Hey, this part doesn't go here. Sometimes you can only have so many people loaded into one building at the same time. So schedules are shifted and now I can't talk to my more experienced tech. And I'm coming in here and I'm just trying to train. I'm trying to learn as much as I can. Now I don't have the people to learn from.
Yeah. Has that gotten better now?
From what I've noticed, yes.
Good.
A lot of the stuff that we see now, at least on the production side, still good. Some brands are different than others, and we'll talk about that a little bit later for build quality. But overall,
let's talk about that now. I mean, like Thor has this reputation, even though it's kind of ridiculous because Thor owns like 92 different companies, and Airstream is one of them, which has a different reputation from, say, Forest River or whatever. You know, do you notice trends like, oh, here's one of those where they stapled everything wrong or whatever?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
First off, have you heard the acronym for Thor?
No.
Trash heap on road.
Okay. And towed by a fix or repair daily. Yes.
Yeah. No, that's just oh my gosh, that's just funny. This kind of spills into like the overall brands. I'm sad to say Coleman. Not build quality good, at least for the travel trailers that I've noticed.
Sorry, Hal.
The build quality on their travel trailers is not good. It's a lot of stapled together furniture. I don't mind the layouts, and you can separate some of the different aspects of these campers. So like the layouts, and some of these are a lot cooler, and then some of them are just pretty basic, but they've got the basics done right.
Mm-hmm.
I started getting into the RV industry at an RV dealer that's specified in like the Coleman brands.
Right.
So I saw a lot more of them. So that could be a bias that I have.
That's a good point. Yeah. That obviously, if you are working with something like, you know, the people in the Sprinter forums will be like, oh, like Sprinters are terrible. Just look at all these comments. And I always say, yeah, go look at the comments in the Transit and ProMaster forums before you compare, because that's all these forums are all like that.
Exactly. And I will say, like, if you go get some experience yourself and stuff, you can go to RV dealers and just say, hey, I want to take a tour in some units. And they might not give you much time to look in a couple of units. You know, go get your own opinion about stuff. Go see what it's like in person for you, if you can. Because everybody's got their opinion biases. Winnebagos are
variable.
I don't know. The variable.
First off, there's a lot of them.
There's so many different ones.
Yeah.
And you always tend to hear about the worst stuff. That's in everything in the world. You always hear about the bad. You never really hear about the good. The one thing that I can say positively is, for me personally and for my other technicians that we've noticed, Furrion products tend to be pretty good.
Oh, that's good to know. So you like Furrion.
Okay. Do like Furrion. Their ACs, their hot water heaters, their furnaces tend to be pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Dometic stuff, I have heard bad things about their ACs. I've heard that, and I don't know exactly what model of Dometics, but I have heard the Coleman Mach 1s.
Yeah.
I have hauled a lot of those to the scrapyard.
Interesting.
Personally.
They're so common.
They're very common. The GEs as well.
My Airstream is on its second AC. I know it wasn't when I owned it, but I can tell that whoever reinstalled it programmed it wrong, which is a pain in the butt if you don't know what you're doing. My furnace wouldn't come on. It was because the AC was programmed wrong.
Yeah, those all tie together. It's so weird. It's like, to run my furnace, that's a completely separate unit.
Right.
I have to go to my AC to make sure. Yeah. And that's another thing. Like, if you do have somebody looking at your unit for you, you're looking at your camper van for you, they kind of have that experience a little bit.
Yeah.
Me as a newer technician, I really don't have much experience in that way. But something like, I could say, hey, you know, a customer comes in and says, hey, my AC won't blow cold. It's blowing a fan, but when I have it on the cold setting, it's not blowing.
Yeah.
Okay. And I see it's a Coleman Mach 1. Right. And I'm like, I know I can go up underneath there. I can take the inside panel off. I know to look for that purple or blue wire. Mm-hmm. I can hook my ammeter up to it.
Yep.
And if I'm getting a low draw on it, I know that there's no Freon in the system and it needs a new top unit. And that'll take me a whole of about like 30 minutes to look at.
Do water pumps fail a lot? Is that a thing you see frequently?
Keep your tanks clean if you can.
Don't get debris in there.
That's the biggest thing. Get a filter on that.
Okay.
Just because you'd definitely rather have one. Running a pump without water in it isn't usually a big deal.
Interesting.
Yeah, because that all the time.
They don't actually overheat as much because it's rubber or something. Right. But
yeah. Yeah, the glands on the inside.
Yeah.
The brands that we deal with are possibly different as well from stuff you'd find on Amazon
Sure,
that you'd want for
one. Yeah, I go to.
Every product is different, so look at your specifications for your products. That is a big thing.
How about electrical? Like, you know, we always see Blue Sea is like, and Victron is like the pinnacle of electrical. But what do you guys think?
The typical wiring for campers and RVs is very, very basic. It's extremely basic. Like, maybe you'll have like 200 amp hours of battery capacity in like the big, like fifth wheels.
Right, right. That's true.
And then for, you know, your Class A's and Class C's, you usually have a generator or you'll have a shore hookup. Right. You won't have a battery bank.
My big Airstream has the fancy 180 watts of solar. And I'm like, that isn't enough to power this thing for an hour. That's ridiculous.
That is puny.
But RVs are built to be in campgrounds. This is one of the big differences. Most people build their camper vans out to be boondockers. And Correct. Most RVs are built to be in campgrounds. And that is a totally different way of thinking about things.
Yes. And that is something else. I actually talked to our service manager. She's the head of the whole service department, specifically about the difference between Class B's and the rest of our fleet. And a lot of the stuff made for the Class B's, like all of the components are just different from everything else we have on the lot. It kind of comes down to how they're built, right? Mm-hmm. So instead of starting off with a frame and then building a house on top of it, which is the Class A's, the Class C's, it's usually a chassis. And then you slap a house on top of it that has some driving components in it.
Yeah, it's basically a trailer glued to a chassis.
Exactly. And then you have the Class C's, which is a cab and a frame.
Glued to a trailer house. Yeah, yeah. Sorry.
And then you have these Class B's that are a van, first and foremost. They are a vehicle. And then you shove all of the stuff to make it a camper inside. So you've already got a solid shell of a thing that's tried and true and will drive around.
But yeah, it's a totally different way of thinking about stuff. So, all right. Well, that's the most common components. What about windows? You got anything to say about that? Because they seem to come up a lot. Like they leak, and then there was these new windows that don't use butyl tape, except that you really should use the butyl tape.
Right. I know exactly what you're talking about. They'll come with that like foam sealant that sits on the edges.
Yeah.
So what I have noticed a lot with, at least from production, when we get new units in, we have to check them in and like go over the whole thing and make sure nothing's like seriously broken in transit. And a lot of times you'll have sealant that's bad. And so we have to go around and reseal stuff. And a lot of the times, the windows will be pretty bad. And they'll only do on the top of the window. They won't seal underneath, which you could say like, hey, you know what? If water happens to getting through the top, it needs a place to drop out, which I would. Personally, I don't sealant underneath, but I will seal the top and then all the way down to the sides. They'll usually go like a third of the way down the sides of the windows.
Right.
And that kind of goes into a different question altogether about most miles out of a van, like preventative maintenance and additives and stuff.
Yeah, let's jump into that. So, all right. So, in general, what is the maintenance that you really need to do and what stuff doesn't matter so much?
So with the Class B's, it's a little bit different since it is, we just talked about, a pre-made shell that is already sealed up from factory to be a vehicle. We've had a lot more time to make vehicles than we have RVs.
True.
Dealing with that kind of stuff, personally, since I owned a extremely unreliable vehicle, at least some would say, I got into the habit of checking all of my fluids every time I went to the gas station. So it seems like a lot, but I mean, personally, it was just oil for me since it's an air-cooled vehicle. Like, we didn't have coolant. Yeah. But if you're at the gas station, you put the pump in, you know, just go pop your hood real quick. Hey, do I have coolant? Do I have oil? Oh, my oil level's good. Slap that back in there. Do I have windshield wiper fluid for whatever reason? If I don't, okay, maybe top that off. But just kind of keep a tab on those general things for your engine health and maintenance. Keep a tab of like, hey, when was the last time I got an oil change?
But yeah, that's always, I mean, seriously, guys, if you have an engine, oil changes are probably the number one thing to keep on top of.
Absolutely. It's the most used thing in the vehicle, especially if you have a diesel Sprinter ambulance. That sucker's been used probably three times over before you got it.
Yeah, idling. I mean, and it's all those idle hours, not necessarily driving hours, which I've talked about a lot. Also, and just so you know, new Sprinter owners and some of the other vans now too, they're taking away dipsticks. The port is there, but the vehicle doesn't come with the dipstick.
What dipstick allowed that?
Someone at Mercedes, because the Mercedes model is nobody works on the vehicles at all themselves. It's all done at the dealership. And well, anyway, that's a whole other thing. But, you know, we're talking about checking the oil dipstick on some vehicles. You can't. Oh, and one last, this is kind of a thing I wanted to ask you about. It used to be you just check the oil, right? That was simple. But now, depending on the color of the dipstick, you're supposed to check it when it's hot or cold. Have you heard about this?
So for generators, that's typically a thing. You'll want to check them while like they're hot. But as for engines, I can't really think of any that would be like that. I mean, if you're going to check it, typically, if you're going to be at a gas station, your engine's going to be hot. Which you maybe give it like, I don't know, a minute to settle down from throwing around. But like, it doesn't really expand or contract all that much from the oil. So that's kind of my biggest opinion, is just check all your fluids. And then for some reason, like you show up at the gas station, you're like, man, my coolant is really low. You know that for one, it didn't happen that long ago. And now you have a chance to fix it before it becomes an even bigger problem.
Yeah. And that stuff doesn't evaporate. It went somewhere.
Exactly. It'll leak out. It's not just going to kind of go around. And if you do have an oil leak, I mean, for me, engines and Volkswagens, they just leak oil, period. That's just how they are. So I'm not going to talk about that as like an option. Although oil leaks can happen. There are two different kinds of oil leaks. You have an active leak and then a non-active leak. The non-active leaks are the ones that if you see it dripping, it's an active leak. If it's not dripping and it's like seeping everywhere, it's a non-active. Yes. That's where you get like all the caked on grease and everything. Yeah. And those aren't too bad. You just kind of keep an eye on your fluid levels and top off every so often. Like with my wife's, she has a little Nissan Versa, like an old 2013. And I have to top it off with oil all the time because not that it's dripping oil, but it just, the piston rings in the cylinders, like it will seep slowly into the combustion chamber and it'll go up with the oil or with the gasoline.
Oh yeah, right, right.
And it'll come out the tailpipe. Yeah. And sometimes you don't notice it. Sometimes if it's a little crazy, you'll see like blue smoke coming out of your tailpipe. And sometimes you don't. And it's one of those things like you'd have to basically rebuild the whole top of your engine if you'd want to get that 100% sealed fix away. Or you could just ride it out until, you know, it ends up being too big of a problem. If you're puffing blue smoke out like a train, highly recommend looking into something to fix inside of your engine. And that's one of those things, like if you go to the dealer before you actually build out your interior, they'll say something about that.
And depending on what state you live in, you may not be able to get that vehicle registered next year.
This is very true. Being in the state of Mississippi, we don't have state inspections.
Nice. We have emissions inspections in Illinois, but we don't have safety inspections. In Massachusetts, they had everything. Like if you had body rust, you'd have to fix it before they would certify it.
Gosh.
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty strict.
That might be a reason to certify your vehicles in a different state.
If you can register in another state, yeah. I mean, a cracked windshield, I remember, if it was larger than a quarter, you had to get that replaced so they wouldn't let you register it.
Wow.
And that was years ago when I lived there. But still, yeah. So don't let that go, because that's a sign that something very bad is happening. And that's the kind of stuff that you're going to literally get stranded on the side of the road eventually.
Yes. Those are the big things. We gotta look out for the people who are having those issues.
All right. I got two big questions left.
All right.
First one is, what tools should an average person bring with them in their rig at all times?
So the biggest tool I think you should have, and it's kind of ethereal, is YouTube.
Oh, I agree 100%. I agree 100%. Yeah.
So a lot of people are going to be, I don't know if you're going to be mad about this or just like inspired by this, but a lot of the technicians at my dealership, we use YouTube.
Of course.
That is a tool for us. That is one of our most used tools. Because, I mean, there's always going to be something that you've never seen before. Or, hey, I forgot what orientation these wires are supposed to go in. Let me just Google this real quick and I'll see. Instead of taking all the time to like search through manuals and all this and that. And it's like, hey, you know what? Let me just check the internet. And then use your deductive reasoning to figure out. I think learning how to learn is the most important skill, especially as a DIY person.
Absolutely.
And just like, yeah, working on a vehicle and trying to live in it, try and be as self-reliant as possible, learn how to learn.
And what tips do you have for finding a good site versus somebody who's just a blowhard backyard mechanic who thinks he knows everything?
It's kind of a vibe check in a way. And I don't know if that's my new age lingo coming through.
No, I get it. You get a feel for it over time.
You'll maybe try a repair that somebody recommended. and you're like, you can kind of tell based on how the video is taken, or if they're like super set up, if they're like really animated and they're like, hey, like this is the best way of doing this, that, the other. They're trying to sell you at the front gate. Information that's worth knowing will make itself apparent on its own. You don't have to sell good information.
If they're trying to sell you Seafoam or something, like Seafoam fixed my engine, probably not. In fact, how do you feel about additives in general?
Additives, if you are experiencing an issue, like I had a check engine light on my wife's car.
Sure.
I put an additive in there that helped clear out the catalytic converter, cleared that out, and it cleared my code for a little bit, you know? It did it for a little bit because, I mean, it's going to build back up over time.
That's mostly, that's like kerosene or something, right? Or they just, I forget. There's like, it's a simple chemical and it just burns everything out of there.
Right. It just flamethrowers it out, I guess. But for additives, if you're going to be leaving your vehicle for like a month or two, having a good fuel additive in there is probably a good thing to do. Anything that'll say like it'll extend your like gas mileage or anything. Some things that just sound too good to be true.
There's your test.
Are that way. There's your litmus test, just kind of your BS meter.
Yep.
I did see somebody who, I don't know if you've heard much about the hydrogen additives.
Where they're using the battery and water to electrolyze water to make. Yeah, I mean, guys, you're not saving any energy there. You're just using it to do something else.
Exactly. You're just taking water and putting a battery to it, and it's not going to self-sufficient off of your alternator, unfortunately.
Right. I mean, like you're turning electricity into another source of fuel, but you're burning fuel to make the electricity. So the math ain't mathing.
Right. I mean, you could say something about like hooking up to a solar port at your house.
Right.
And then it's like, okay, well, you know what? I'm separating this water into hydrogen and oxygen by hooking up my car to it's almost like a additive EV almost.
Right. Yeah, but you're getting energy from somewhere else. You're not using your vehicle to produce the energy that it's using.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Right. So I think your basic point there is correct. If it looks too good to be true, I mean, honestly, if there's an easy fix, then you already know it. If there's something super simple that will fix a major problem, you would already know it. No one's discovering new stuff like that.
Right.
Yeah. So this magnet will put on your fuel line and make you get 10% more fuel mileage. No, it won't, because the dealers would have done that. The auto manufacturer would have done that since they first discovered it. Okay. So imagine a toolbox for the road. What's
this? Okay. So you'll want a basic socket set just to have on hand, especially as somebody who wants to help other people while they're on the road. You never know what you're going to come across.
Yep.
So I like to have that big full toolbox so I can help out somebody else. But so like a basic socket set, having an open end wrench set or like a crescent wrench set, like three sized ones. I'll have like a tiny one and then like a slightly bigger one. Biggest thing I've used is my chuck drill.
Ah.
So just being able to unscrew and screw in panels, being able to fasten things together.
Yes.
Zip ties, duct tape, the classics. A super glue is always a good one to have around too.
Yep, I have all those things. Yeah, and actually, so spare supply of screws and things like that. Like if you've built out your own rig, keep little spares of any fasteners or fuses or any component like that. They're little things, they don't take up a lot of space. But, you know, if you blow a 20 amp ATC fuse somewhere and it's because you did something stupid and you fixed that problem, well, if you don't have that 20 amp fuse to replace it with, you got nothing.
Absolutely. Fuses is a big thing. Especially like look inside of your components too and see what kind of fuses they have, because sometimes they're different sizes.
Absolutely. Oh,
so like so I know with the Victron, Victron has like their little bus that has those thick old battery, fuses. They're huge. They're like 150 amps. And those suckers, they're kind of hard to find. Yeah. I've had a trouble or time or two where I've had to go to a couple stores to find them. So
I definitely just have some of those. Speaker wire in between them. That's all you need. It'll work.
Yeah, it'll be fine. You'll be all right. Send it down the road.
That was a joke, in case you didn't know.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Another thing, talking engine oil and your fluids and whatnot, just have a gallon of whatever coolant that you have, whatever your oil is. Have one of your oil filters as well. That's a big recommendation.
That's a great idea. And I do. My wife has a 2012 Scion IQ, which is a kind of a rare car these days. And I always have an oil filter in the back, not because I'm going to change the oil necessarily, but because wherever I go to change the oil, they will have it to put on there. And so many times I've taken it in, they're like, oh, we don't have a filter for that.
Mm-hmm. You got to wait for it to ship in or something. Especially
idea.
Like with me having an older vehicle, like it's right. just, it's nice to have everything I need in case, because you never know. Now, not so much with the Class Bs, since they're pretty sealed up as units, but if anybody's in a travel trailer, you're in a teardrop, or you have like a Class A or Class C, have a caulk gun and some like clear silicone and some Dicor or like roof sealant material.
You said the S word.
What's that?
Silicone word. Now,
silicone.
I've heard that you should never use silicone on an RV in any way because it's not as good as the other stuff. Nothing will ever stick to it and it's a pain in the butt to remove. But what is your experience?
So for silicone, never use it on the roof. On roof materials, you do not want to use silicone. You always want to be using the self-leveling stuff, because it's meant to be up there. It's meant to adhere to a lot of like rubber roofs, is what you typically find on travel trailers and fifth wheels and stuff, and on some drivables as well. So I can't remember exactly the different brands, but self-leveling material, you can fit it in a caulk gun, use it like a caulk gun. You just plop it on. Again, you can YouTube to see how to properly do it.
Right. That's it.
But silicone, specifically silicone for side panels.
Okay.
So that is what we use for all of our side panels over like windowsills and stuff. You were talking about how windows tend to leak and whatnot. So you can use silicone, and I recommend clear just because it looks better.
Yeah,
and you can't tell
everything. Like
exactly.
You know, oh, I need brown now for What I have to ask, Flex Seal?
I have not personally had good experiences with Flex Seal.
Yeah.
It's another one of those things that's like maybe a little too good to be true.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just that I'm not prepping the area well enough. Because that is another huge thing, is being able to prep your surface to a better degree. Because I am experiencing a lot of that with doing a lot of metal work right now, is how you prep your metal. But highly, highly recommend having a tube of silicone on you, some clear silicone. Do make, there is a clear non-sag self-level, like I say self-leveling. There is a clear, I'm just going to call it Dicor brand. It's like
Duramax. That's what I mean. Yeah, that's fine.
They do make that. So like for the side caps of like big drivables, you'll usually have like the rubber roof that'll like come over the lip about like six inches or so.
Yep.
And then you'll have that strip that then goes to your metal siding. A lot of times you'll have like the non-self-leveling stuff. You just strip it up there and it looks like garbage. We use the clear stuff and you can't even tell it's there.
No kidding. All right. That's a great tip. I didn't even know that stuff existed.
Yes.
Now, electrical wise, I'm guessing in your toolbox, you're going to have a multimeter.
Absolutely. That is a big thing. I'm going to recommend you get one of the ones that has the big clamp on it.
Okay.
I know that Klein has one for like $70, $80.
Yeah, they're expensive.
The very basic one. That is one of those tools you'll buy for life and never need to buy another one again if you treat it right. And they usually come with like a little carrying case, you know, you just keep that around, because having the ability to not like probe your wires.
Right.
Is so nice. And I'm having to buy one of those myself soon. It's one of those things, I've borrowed too much from my coworkers and they're starting to get annoyed at me for like, hey, can I borrow your multimeter?
Yeah.
They're like, shut up, go to Home Depot, kid. Like,
and
get
just
off.
Just a note for folks. So multimeters we've talked about a lot, some of them have a clamp and you put the clamp around the wire and it can tell you if there's like electricity going through the wire. So it's a non-destructive diagnostic tool. However, the cheap multimeters with the clamps only do that for AC. They don't do it for DC. So if you want one for your rig, you want to get a more expensive one, make sure specifically that the clamp can work for DC.
Correct. It should say that on the packaging. I believe that the cheaper Klein one only does AC. There's a one for $100.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it does AC and DC. Rock on.
And they do it a little bit differently. The AC one's detecting changes and the DC one is actually detecting what's going on. So anyway.
Right.
Not to drill down too much on that, but that sounds like a pretty solid kit to me. And, you know, the kit that you bring is more, it's not a list so much as a way of thinking. What are you going to need? What can you imagine bad happening? And then what will you do to fix those things?
Exactly.
And that's also an experience thing. And I have to say, you're always going to have a fire extinguisher.
Always have a fire extinguisher. Another thing, before I forget, have a pair of dirty clothes to put on when you're doing stuff. Just have it rolled up. Learn how to do like the military roll where you like pack everything up in like a really small thing. It's not that hard. It's actually really fun and satisfying when you have a shirt like the size of a soda can.
Right.
And then you just shove that in like a Walmart bag and put it with your toolkit and just be like, hey, you know what? It's time for me to do some really dirty work. I got to crawl up under the van and I've got asphalt all underneath me.
Right.
Don't ruin your nice, pretty shirt and your wife's going to yell at you about that. Just, I don't know. My wife doesn't really yell at me about that stuff, but I don't know. That's the joke. That's
the joke. Next time someone's giving away free t-shirts and it's like something you don't care about, like, you know, whatever. A guy gave me a free t-shirt because I was working on my van in the parking lot of the Home Depot. It's like, hey, you a plumber? Here's a plumbing shirt. I'm like, no. But I asked him for a double X large because I don't wear a double X large. And because it's a giant shirt, if I have to work on something suddenly, I could just put this over whatever the heck I'm wearing and I'm covered.
That's a good point.
I don't care about it, you know?
Yeah.
So the next thing, though, related to this is your hands by the end of the day are horrible. What do you do about that?
I don't do anything about them. I just have a lot of cuts. I look like a hardworking guy.
Yeah, me too. My hands are all beat up. But what did you do for like even grease?
For grease, I do not use brake cleaner.
I've had coworkers
who do that, and I make the joke. I'm like, dude, something, you're going to grow an extra arm or something. Yeah. Like, something's going to happen. It dries your hands out so bad.
Oh, so they go over to the safety clean and just rinse their hands off in there?
Yeah.
Oh.
It's awful. So what I tend to do is I'll usually just have like a rag or something. I'll try and wipe my hands. I try and wear gloves when I can, especially for oil changes.
Oh, yeah.
Because that stuff, if you're dealing with it like one time,
right,
it's not going to be as bad. But for somebody in the industry who I see this all the time and I deal with this stuff every single day, it will wear on your hands.
Absolutely.
Have a little box of gloves, maybe some like nitrile gloves. Go for like the 7 mil thick ones at the very least, because the thickness will save you on a couple of cuts for sure.
Make sure you get the right kind of gloves too, because different kinds of gloves let different chemicals in them. And I think neoprene is good for oil, but not for, there was something common that would go through neoprene. I forget what it was. But make sure you're using the right gloves. You can look it up. Don't listen to me. Look it up. What do you use to get the grease off your hands? Do you use like Dawn or Lest Oil or just scrub really hard?
So I have a thing of like, what is it? Orange peel.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll use that sometimes. I've got it in my kitchen. What I find works really well is Dawn and salt. And you'll just put them together, rub your hands, and that works really well.
Well, that's great advice because you're going to have those anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, good. All right. Well, let's move on to something totally different. And the last specific question, what do you do to keep rodents out of your van or your truck or anything? Is there anything that actually works?
Okay. So it's funny you mentioned this because right now in my bay at my shop, I have a giant fifth wheel that was absolutely littered with rodents. I'm talking like in the underbelly, in the walls, inside of couches. Like, this place was rodent heaven.
No, seriously, why isn't this in a field on fire somewhere? Because that's the only future I see.
So, yeah, the only reason it's still in the shop is because, you know, the insurance company's paying for it. And instead of coming out of pocket and just buying a whole new unit, they're like, it's the sunk cost fallacy. And they're like, we can fix it. We can change him. And it's kind of just been a money pit. It's one of those things that the technicians will kind of pick at a little bit if they have time and they can flag a couple of hours on it.
It's terrible.
But it's been handed off to me.
Lucky you.
Oh yes, lucky me. Because it's been in the hands of like three different technicians who have no longer like been at my location, and I'm just like, I'm going to try and get this gone as fast as possible. I'm not even going to worry about it.
Chewed wires, urine soaked subfloor. I mean,
everything. It is awful. There's water damage. There's everything. I had to cut out the entire underbelly of this fifth wheel, and there was hydraulic leaks because it's got hydraulic lift jacks. So everything's coated in hydraulic fluid. Then you've got, it had a pond underneath of just, there's like an algae that'll build up inside of your tanks sometimes.
Right, yes,
and that's just, even in the brand new units, it'll make its way in there, and it looks like fecal matter. It's not, it doesn't smell great and it doesn't look great. I'm very lucky I didn't pour any of it on me, but I remember cutting out just a big section of it to let it drain. And it took about like 15 minutes to drain it out. But they got to everything. They got to the hydraulic lines. They got to the water lines. They got to the electrical.
Nope.
It was nasty. And then there was the added bonus of, now there's poop everywhere as well.
Nope. That is, well, anyway, My solution is you burn it. That's clearly the right answer for this problem. But
I have asked, I've put in time to do that, and they won't let me send it to the bonfire. So unfortunately, that got denied.
Oh,
warranty okay. Did not approve.
So when these people come to their senses and actually get a new rig, which will happen.
Yes.
What would you tell them about keeping rodents out of their rig?
So if you're going to leave it for a long time, which is what it happened with this guy, keep it in a place that's got short grass. This thing is like pretty high off the ground. It's like a couple feet off the ground with the axles and everything, mm-hmm. and they still manage to get in. So try and keep it in a different location, no tall grass, nothing like that, that could like reach up to get there. Don't give them a way of getting in.
Right.
As of like additives or like you've heard of like peppermint people use or stuff like that.
Irish Spring.
Yeah. Things like that. Never really had any luck with that. I think it's more just about like keep all of everything out of your vehicle if you're going to leave it for a long period of time.
No food.
Take all the food out. Take all of your water out. Drain your tanks. Winterize your unit. Like all of that stuff. Just if you're going to leave it for a good amount of time. Make sure there is no water anywhere to be had. Maybe the rats will come in, they'll pick at a hose or something, mm-hmm. find there's no water in the entire thing, no food anywhere, and then they'll leave. And the worst thing that you're going to have is a little bit of damage to your system, right. And it won't be crazy. But if they find that your place is the place to be, they'll stick around, they'll make a nest, and then you'll have a lot more problems.
Yeah.
So it's really just about prepping your vehicle for if you leave it for long periods of time. If you're living in a vehicle, and this happens, it's typically, hey, you found it, and there might be a little bit of damage to it. You can typically hear them putting around if you're in a smaller, like especially like a Sprinter van or something. You can kind of hear them putting around and dig in and whatnot. So, and that's another added benefit of having a dog or a cat in your vehicle.
That's true.
That's your fix. Just
get a cat.
Get a cat, get a dog, something. But yeah, just prep your vehicle before you leave it for long periods of time. That's what I have the experience with. And
so exclusion is the big thing. I mean, it's hard because they can get in tiny little spaces. But yeah, I mean, you know, if you fill things with steel wool or spray foam, if you know what you're doing and you're careful or whatever. But and then, of course, the next question is, they're in your van. Like you parked your van for a couple months, you came back and there's a mouse living in there. What do you do? And should you try to save the poor little mousey?
I personally believe in trying to save everything that you can.
Wow. Okay.
I don't like killing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's how I won my wife. You know, that's how I won my wife. We were on our first date and there was a dragonfly sitting on the ground and I just like put it in a bush and she was like, this is my man.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So I try to preserve that part of myself because it feels like the good thing to do. And that's my ethos. You know, that's not really my tech side coming out, but roaches can die, personally. I don't care for roaches.
So insects is okay.
Mosquitoes. Insects are okay. That's where I draw the line. That's my line.
So what do you do? You said I have a heart trap or?
It's one of the things that you give it the easiest shot that you can. You have one of the live traps. You set it in there. If that ends up not working, you give it every opportunity that you can to try and save it. But if you can't and they keep persisting, you got to get some regular traps. I don't like the glue traps.
No, either.
I don't like the glue traps because that's overly cruel.
Yeah.
I will say for when I was living in Tennessee as a whitewater raft guide, we had a raccoon problem.
Jeez.
So any other like wildlife, whenever you're dealing with food and whatnot, obviously I had to learn this the hard way. Don't keep your food outside.
Of course.
Because I had the raccoons visit me all the time.
Yep.
And we had to have a live trap set in my tent because I was like, I know they come to my place all the time. So I caught a raccoon once. That was a fun experience.
Oh yeah. They're friendly, aren't they? They're really cuddly.
They look cute. Oh, you look so cute. And then you stepped a little closer. They had a really inhumane way of taking care of them. I won't say it. But it's one of those things, like, especially in the state of Tennessee, and I'm sure it differs state to state, but if an animal gets a hold of human food, you are no longer allowed legally to set them free in the wild. That is a legal thing. So you unfortunately do have to put them down.
Mm-hmm.
Just as humanely as you can.
Yeah.
Just try to do that. Mm-hmm. It's not great. Or call like wildlife services. I've had to do that before. They're typically really nice about taking the animal away so you don't have to deal with that. You let the people whose job it is to take care of those things deal with them. And they do not charge you. This is like a state thing. I've had I've had instances where I've found like animals on the side of the road, dead, and or rather, you know, like somewhat living.
Yeah, the worst.
And some things you can save, some things you can't, and you need to let the professionals decide whether or not that's the right thing to do.
Right. It's very complicated. There are some, like a starling, for example, if you get a starling with a broken leg. Well, in Illinois, they kill thousands of starlings every day at the airport. They trap them and kill them because they're bringing planes down. So, man. It's a complicated thing. Like, should you save the starling? That's an invasive species. And that's, yeah. So that's why calling the professionals is always the thing to do, because they know.
Yes.
They know what makes sense. And it's a lot more than just about, oh, this poor animal is in need. There's a big picture, too, to look at. And sadly, it's because of that that I have given up on trying to save mice. I mean, if I was in the rig full time and there was a mouse in there, I would treat that differently. But where I'm leaving my rigs unattended and I have spent literally thousands of dollars repairing damage from mice, and there are so many mice in the woods, I mean, you know, they can breed something like hundreds in a year,
right?
I just have plain old mouse traps out, and that has solved my problem, believe it or not. That's pretty much, I just leave the traps out with some peanut butter and I change them every time I go. Yeah. So anyway,
it seems like the option, unfortunately.
I
mean, but
I know, yeah. I hate it. I'm not a fan of it at all, but the other option is then I lose my rig, basically.
Exactly. And for some people, like, that's worth it, you know? Some people say, you know what, the rats made that their home and now it's theirs and I'm okay with that. And more power to those people. I respect their ethos so much. But at the same time, like, it's the balancing act. It's the world's balancing act of, like, what you can, I hate to say the word deal with, because that seems a little bit harsher, but
yeah, that's right.
It's what you can personally put up with and what you're okay with, you know, sacrificing. So, yep, the classic mousetrap seems to be the best ethos way for the common man, the middle ground. So yeah, that's what I'll recommend.
Instant death solves the problem. You're not having any suffering. There's no secondary contamination like with decon and all the poisons that mouse gets sick, runs outside, hawk eats it, hawk dies. You know, you don't have that.
Right.
However, I will say there's one thing that I have had with my traps is something else is getting into my rig and eating the dead mice. Sometimes mice will do that, but in this case, it's something bigger, because all that's left is the bone that is trapped under the trap. This might be too gruesome for the podcast, but literally something is getting in and eating everything except the bone that is trapped under the metal wire. And I think it's a mink. I can't figure out what else could do that.
Interesting. Anyway, being in the South, I think snake, and I'm like, oh gosh.
You know, yeah, that's not impossible. I mean, obviously we have snakes up here too, but anyway, it's kind of creepy. Move your rig a lot.